Chapter 1. The Refuge Tree of the Triratna Buddhist Order and the Prostration Practice. Jamyang Kyentse Chokyi Lodro was one of the foremost Tibetan Buddhist teachers of his time. Sangharakshita met him in 1957 and received several significant initiations from him. One of Jamyang Kyentse's chief disciples was Kashu Rinpoche, abbot of Pema Yangtze, the royal monastery of Sikkim. In 1960, at Jamyang Kyentse's behest, Kashu Rinpoche initiated Sangharakshita into the practice of Guru Padmasambhava. At the same time, Rinpoche gave Sangharakshita a new name, Urgyan, the name of Padmasambhava's mythical homeland. Sangharakshita had long felt a deep connection with Padmasambhava. He had first encountered him in 1950 in a temple in Darjeeling in the form of a sculpture, 3 or 4 times life-size. In seeing the figure of Padmasambhava, he later wrote, "I had become conscious of a spiritual presence that had in fact been with me all the time. Though I had never seen the figure of Padmasambhava before, it was familiar to me in a way that no other figure on earth was familiar. Familiar and fascinating. It was familiar as my own self, yet at the same time infinitely mysterious, infinitely wonderful, and infinitely inspiring." End quote. The day after the initiation, Sangharakshita came upon a Tibetan monk selling a few woodblock prints of texts in the Kalimpong Bazaar. Wanting to help the man who was clearly in need, Sangharakshita gave him what little money he had and took the texts back to Kashu Rinpoche, who was then staying with him at his vihara. Rinpoche was delighted to find that they were Nyingma texts, mostly relating to Padmasambhava. He took this as an auspicious sign and a mark of the success of the initiation. Among the texts was the Tharpe Delam, or Easy Path to Emancipation, which, besides other things, gives an account of the 4 foundation yogas, or preliminary trainings. In particular, it described one of the Nyingma refuge trees, and outlined a form of the going for refuge and prostration practice. Obtaining the necessary permission from Kashu Rinpoche and translating the text with the help of Dado Rinpoche, Sangharakshita took up this prostration practice and continued with it for the remainder of his stay in Kalimpong. The refuge tree, which is also known as the refuge assembly or field of merit, is a central symbol in Vajrayana Buddhism. It is a visualization practice centered on the 3 refuges, the Buddha, the Dharma, and the Noble Sangha, represented by a vast array of figures, all of whom vary depending upon the system of thought and practice of the different schools of Tibetan Buddhism. For the Kagyupas, for instance, the central form is usually the Buddha Vajradhara. For the Gelugpas, it is Jade Tsongkhapa. And for the Nyingma Pas, it is Padmasambhava. Traditionally, it is possible to visualize a refuge tree with any archetypal enlightened form, or Yidam, at its center. You build up a visualization with whichever yidam you are most devoted to appearing at the centre. And then, according to traditional arrangements, you organise all the other refuges around it. You can also condense the practice, visualising only the central figure, while sustaining a strong conviction that it embodies all the refuges. Although there are many different refuge trees, depending on the exact lineage within which one practices, they all more or less conform to a single pattern. The refuges appear in the clear blue sky, the great scholars, the yogins and the yidams that are central to the lineage in question, as well as those dharkanis and dharmapalas with whom it has a particular connection. All these are ranged about the central figure, who is said to embody them all. The practice of repeatedly prostrating before a visualized refuge tree is common to all the schools of Tibetan Buddhism. When this practice is performed as part of the set of Vajrayana preliminary practices, such as those described in the Tharpe Delam, it is customary to perform 100,000 prostrations in all, usually over several years. When he returned to the West and founded the Triratna Buddhist Order, Sangharakshita passed on the Tharpe Delam, going for refuge and prostration practice, centred on Guru Padmasambhava, to those of his own disciples who wished to do it regularly, and for many years members of the Triratna Buddhist Order followed the Nyingma approach to the four foundation yogas. Over time, however, Sangharakshita's thinking about the centrality of going for refuge to the three jewels and his understanding of the Dharma began to crystallize in a new way. Previously, he had more or less accepted the traditional Vajrayana view of the path as ascending by degrees from the Hinayana, which was concerned primarily with self-liberation, to the Mahayana, which upholds the Bodhisattva ideal, to the Vajrayana, the path of magical transformation. Sangharakshita later came to regard this view as the unfortunate result of what he called ultraism. Tibetan, Chinese and Japanese masters, he now thought, had tried to make sense of the various teachings which had historically preceded them and which had been given canonical status by arranging them in complex sequences. This was the only way they could resolve certain contradictions. On the one hand, what had gone before was thought of as the direct teaching of the Buddha. On the other hand, it was often clear that reforms were needed and that the Dharma would be best expressed in ways that were in keeping with the needs of the time. In this way, at each stage, new teachings arose that included, but claimed to go beyond, whatever had gone before. The Mahayana included, but extended, the teachings of what it called the Hinayana. The Vajrayana claimed to include, but go beyond, the Mahayana. Eventually, in the case of the Nyingma tradition, 9 different yanas, or ways, emerged. But Westerners today often cannot, and certainly need not, accept these traditional schematizations of the teaching. To begin with, they have no basis in history. We know that the Buddha did not literally teach many of the doctrines later attributed to him. This is not to deny the spiritual value of such doctrines, but they cannot be regarded as literally the word of the Buddha Shakyamuni. Moreover, at this point in history, we stand as inheritors of the whole Buddhist tradition. As such, we are called upon to make sense of the various classificatory schemata that the different traditions present. But these conflict. The Tibetan traditions place the Theravada in the Hinayana camp, but there are teachings in the Pali Canon that the Theravadins follow which are clearly directed at individuals at a high level of attainment. Some Theravadins, for their part, regard Mahayana Buddhism as a later Brahminical degeneration. And where do the Chinese and Japanese schools fit in? There seem to be close parallels, for example, between Zen and Dzogchen, the highest teachings of the Nyingma Vajrayana. But Zen is ranked as Mahayana, a stage beneath the Vajrayana. Besides the problems of trying to reconcile all the different systems of classification, there is also the issue of spiritual snobbery. Many people in the West today like to think they have the best, the highest, the most powerful teachings, and this often leads them to take up practices that are way beyond them, sometimes barely intelligible and even literally fantastic. For most ordinary practitioners, for example, the idea that they themselves are literally bodhisattvas, actually devoting their lives to saving all beings, can lead to a spiritual life that is divorced from reality. For many, this might be nothing worse than a harmless dream, but at worst it can lead to inflation and arrogance. In any case, the stack of teachings has simply become too high, and it's time to go back. Otherwise, we will simply have stack upon stack of practices which claim to have superseded one another as the highest teaching. Instead, we should focus our attention on the earliest developments of the Dharma, which are closer to the Buddha's own time and to the Buddha himself. We are in the fortunate position of being able to do this on account of our peculiarly Western historical perspective and because of the tools of historical analysis we have inherited. Buddhists of former times lacked these means. This return to basic principles does not mean ignoring or discarding later developments. Rather, it involves seeing them in the context of the earlier teachings. The entire later Buddhist tradition grew out of the Buddha's own teaching. It amplified and elaborated it, but did not supersede it or add new and higher stages. Behind the vast mass of the Buddhist tradition lies a continuous underlying transcendental unity. So where did this all leave the Thapa Delam, the Nyingma Foundation Yogas, and the refuge tree of the Guru Padmasambhava? As Sangharakshita's thought and teaching on the subject became increasingly clear, it also started to become clear to him and to some of the senior order members charged with leading the ordination training process of the Triratna Buddhist Order, that practices such as those outlined in the Thapa Delam come to us freighted with an immense weight of assumptions which we no longer share. The foundation yogas, for example, are traditionally thought of as preliminary practices. Preliminary, that is, to entry into the Vajrayana path, which one traditionally embarks upon only when one has first traversed the Hinayana and Mahayana paths. In other words, if one were to take this tradition at its word, one would need to be at least a fairly advanced bodhisattva before taking one's first tantric initiation. This rule has lately been more often broken than kept. Indeed, some Tibetan Buddhist teachers have developed the custom of giving out initiations to Westerners en masse, sometimes with scant regard to proper preparation. As it became increasingly clear that the Triratna Buddhist Order no longer shared some of the doctrinal assumptions that underpinned the Vajrayana approach to practice, so it also became clear that a new approach was called for. In 1992, in consultation with a few senior members of the order, Sangharakshita devised and published a new set of preliminary practices. Where relevant, these placed Shakyamuni, the historical Buddha, back at the centre of the refuge assembly, thus reaffirming his position at the very heart of the order's teaching. The new refuge tree that Sangharakshita devised included figures from the entire Buddhist tradition, figures from different schools, traditions and countries, India, Tibet, China and Japan. The order draws upon the whole Buddhist tradition for its teachings and inspiration. For the first time in Buddhist history, a truly global pan-Buddhist refuge tree had come into being. Although based on traditional lines, this new refuge tree is simpler than most, it has far fewer figures upon it than the tree from the Thapa Delam, for example. Many people have difficulty visualizing even one bodhisattva, let alone the hosts of beings one finds on many of the traditional refuge trees. Sangharakshita wanted to make the new tree as easy as possible to visualize, without losing any of the major elements. At the same time, he has stressed that once one has become familiar with the primary figures, one can always add further traditional elements to one's visualization. For instance, one can see beautiful offerings being made to the refuge tree. One begins the practice by sitting down in meditation and establishing a working basis of concentration and emotional positivity. Then one visualizes a clear blue sky stretching out in all directions, vast and unimpeded. Out of the sky, a rainbow-coloured cloud appears, and growing up from the cloud, an enormous stem that soars upwards into the sky, bearing at its tip a huge white lotus flower in radiant full bloom. In the centre of the lotus flower appears the Buddha Shakyamuni, the Buddha of the present era, shining with golden light. To his right and left, slightly smaller than him, appear the Buddhas of the past and the future, Dipankara and Maitreya, the Buddha of the past and the future. Together, these three figures represent the principle of enlightenment, in which is found the transcendental unity of Buddhism that transcends time and space. Then four other lotuses appear, growing out from the central stem, one to the front and one behind the main flower, one to the left and one to the right. On the lotus flower in front of the Buddha of the three times appears Sangharakshita and his eight main teachers, seated in three tiers. Sangharakshita finds his place here not as the centre of a cult of personality, but rather because he is the link between order members and the wider Buddhist tradition. Each of the teachers is, in his turn, a link with that tradition. Sangharakshita sits in the centre of the frontier. To his left is Bhikkhu Jagdish Kashyap, wearing the yellow robes of a Theravadin monk. To his right is Yogi Chen, wearing his grey Chinese scholar's robe, our link with the Chan tradition. On the next tier above Yogi Chen sits Chetul Sankyo Dorje in his Tibetan costume. To his left is Kashu Rinpoche, dressed in Nyingma monastic robes. Dado Rinpoche, wearing the red monastic robes of a Tibetan Gelung, appears next to him. On the third tier above Dado Rinpoche sits Dilgo Khyentse Rinpoche. Next to him, Jamyang Khyentse Rinpoche, and then Dujong Rinpoche, all wearing the robes of Tibetan yogi lay practitioners. There is a significance in the arrangement of these figures that goes back to the story of the finding of the Thapa Delam texts in the Kalimpong Bazaar. Because of his spiritual eminence, because of the significance of the initiations he received from him, Sangharakshita regards Jamyang Khyentse Rinpoche as his root guru. Khyentse Rinpoche handed Sangharakshita over, as it were, to Kashu Rinpoche, who gave him the Padmasambhava initiation. This line of transmission is indicated on the tree by the fact that Kashu Rinpoche sits above Sangharakshita's head, with Jamyang Khyentse Rinpoche above Kashu Rinpoche. Above both of them, and central to the teachers of the past, is the great guru Padmasambhava. On the lotus flower to the right of the Buddha appear the five bodhisattvas of the refuge tree. They demonstrate the order's embracing of the bodhisattva ideal in all its aspects and its drawing upon the highest resources of the imagination. There is the four-armed Avalokiteshvara, brilliant white in colour, Manjushri, golden yellow with his sword and book. Royal blue Vajrapani with his golden vajra. Pshitigarbha with his monk's robes and mendicant staff. And green Tara. Opposite them, to the left of the Buddhas, are the five Arhants. Some of the chief among the Buddha's own immediate disciples, who embody the basic teachings of Buddhism and are the source of their transmission to the present time. There are his two chief disciples, Shariputra holding a rosary and Moggallana with a palm leaf manuscript. Ananda, the Buddha's friend and attendant, holds a mendicant staff. And Mahakashyapa, who led the Sangha after the Buddha's death, holds a scripture to his heart. Dharmadina, the nun who excelled in Dharma teaching and whose insight into cyclic and spiral conditionality had an important effect on Sangharakshita's thinking, makes the gesture of Dharma teaching. On the lotus behind the Buddhas is a vast stack of Dharma texts, the canonical teachings of the Buddha, the Tripitaka. In the sky above the Buddha appear the teachers of the past. These are the principal historical figures from whose teaching and commentaries we derive our inspiration and understanding of the Dharma. At the top are the teachers connected with Indian Buddhism. Arya Nagarjuna, with his halo of serpents, founder of the Majjhimaka tradition. The brothers Asanga and Vasubandhu, who between them founded the Yogacara, wear their pandit's hats, as does Shantideva, the author of the Bodhicharya Avatara, a text much studied in the order and from which is derived the Triratna Buddhist community puja. Buddha Ghosha, the great teacher of the Theravada, holds up his Visuddhimagga. Beneath these appear the teachers connected with Tibet. Milarepa, the poet saint of the Kagyupas, sits at ease wearing his thin white cotton cloth. Atisha, an Indian teacher who reformed much of Buddhism in Tibet, makes the gesture of teaching. Padmasambhava, who played a central part in establishing Buddhism in Tibet and who is especially revered in the Nyingma tradition, wears his three coloured robes. And Tsongkhapa, revered as the founder of the Gelug school, holds the stems of lotuses which support a sword and a book, the emblems of Manjushri, at his shoulders. Then come the teachers from China, Hui Neng, the sixth patriarch of the Chan school, Chia Yi, founder of the Tiantai, and Xuanzang, the great translator, scholar and pilgrim. Finally, there are the teachers from Japan. Hakuan, the great Rinzai Zen reformer, sits with his Kyosaku, or wake-up stick. Kukai, the founder of the Shingon esoteric school, holds his Vajra and rosary. Dogen, founder of the Soto Zen school, sits on his teaching seat, and Shinran, founder of the True Pure Land School, clasps a rosary. Above the refuge tree appear the Jinnas, the archetypal Buddhas of the five directions, embodying the principal aspects of transcendental wisdom. White Verochana at the centre makes the gesture of teaching. Blue Akshobhya in the east touches the earth. Yellow Ratnasambhava in the south makes the gesture of boundless giving. Red Amitabha in the west sits in meditation. And dark green Amoghasiddhi in the north wards off fear. Finally, in the sky above the five Jinnas, the Adi Buddha, the pure white Vajrasattva, embodying the Dharma in its complete wordless purity, sits holding his bell and vajra, radiating brilliant light. Gods and goddesses appear in the sky around this great refuge tree, singing and dancing, making all kinds of offerings, and luminous rainbow light fills the sky. One sits for a time, holding the magnificent vision of the tree in one's mind, developing a sense of its vast beneficent influence, and then one moves on to the next stage of the practice. Keeping the vision of the tree before you, you imagine that your mother and all women are to your left, your father and all men to your right, and then, with hands held in reverence at your heart, you recite this verse. From now onwards, until the attainment of enlightenment, with great reverence of body, speech and mind, I go for refuge to the Buddha Shakyamuni. Then you perform the first prostration. You bring your hands, still held in the gesture of reverence, to your head, then to your throat, then your heart, representing body, speech and mind, as you recite, Om Ah Hung, to the best of all refuges I go. Then you make a full-length prostration to the refuge tree in front of you. You go down onto your knees and stretch your whole body out on the floor, your arms in front of you. You then lift your folded hands up above your head in reverence. As you go down onto the floor, you recite to yourself, to the Buddha for refuge I go, to the Dharma for refuge I go, to the Sangha for refuge I go. Then you stand up and repeat the process, Om Ah Hung, to the best of all refuges I go, and prostrate, to the Buddha for refuge I go, to the Dharma for refuge I go, to the Sangha for refuge I go. Over and over, as many times as you wish, always trying to keep a clear sense of the refuge tree before you. Having done that for a time, you stand up and return to your seat, all the time maintaining your visualization. Now clear white light streams down from the refuges onto you, your mother and all women, your father and all men, cleansing and purifying them. You sit for a time basking in the radiance of purifying light before the light is drawn back into the refuges and you begin the final stage of the practice. Vajrasattva, the five Buddhas, the teachers of the past, the Arhants, the Dharma texts, Bodhisattvas and the teachers of the present, all, one group at a time, dissolve into white light which is absorbed into the Buddhas of the three times. Dipankara and Maitreya dissolve into light which is absorbed into the Buddha Shakyamuni. The Buddha himself dissolves into light, which is absorbed into the clear blue sky, and then the sky itself gradually fades away. You sit for a time, absorbing the impact of the practice, and then transfer the merits of having done it with verses such as these. May the merit gained in my acting thus go to the alleviation of the suffering of all beings. My personality throughout my existences, my possessions and my merit in all three ways, I give up without regard to myself for the benefit of all beings. Just as the earth and other elements are serviceable in many ways to the infinite number of beings inhabiting limitless space, so may I become that which maintains all beings situated throughout space, so long as all have not attained to peace. With that, you bring the practice to a close. Not everyone is equally able to visualize, and some people, for health reasons, find making a full-length prostration very difficult. But such a prostration is not essential. One of my friends bows from his wheelchair. Others make a half prostration, like the Chinese kowtow. Or one can simply stand or sit and bow from the waist. The important thing is to make a physical gesture of reverence, receptivity and submission. To express as vigorously as you can, and with the whole of your being, the act of going for refuge to the three jewels. The Buddha, the Dharma, and the resplendent Arya Sangha embodied by the tree. The physical and verbal aspects of this practice are as significant as the mental ones. After reciting the threefold refuge formula, to the Buddha for refuge I go, to the Dharma for refuge I go, to the Sangha for refuge I go, we usually recite a list of precepts indicating our intention to live out that going for refuge in every aspect of our lives. This is important, for unless the act of going for refuge to the three jewels is extended into all areas of our lives, it can easily remain a merely theoretical matter. By practicing a set of ethical precepts, we bring the nitty-gritty dimension of our daily life into line with our intention to go for refuge. The prostration practice has a similar effect. Joining our hands together and prostrating, we engage the whole of our body. Reciting the verses of refuge, we engage our speech. And by developing and maintaining the visualized image, we engage our mind. In this way, the whole of our psychophysical organism is brought into relation with the mythic dimension of the three refuges. The spark of what is ultimate in us responds to the great blaze that is the refuge tree. And by acting out our relationship to the visualized tree, we take an active part in the cosmic drama of going for refuge, the drama of total transformation from unenlightened being to enlightened being, embodied by the tree itself. The effects of the practice are cumulative. The more time you spend in the presence of the refuges, the more they are able to stir your depths. After a time, you may come to feel that with each prostration you are, literally, throwing yourself more and more fully into the spiritual life. The more you do so, the more natural it becomes, as all your stiffness of pride is gradually softened and worn away. It's a wonderful thing to be living in a universe in which beings as evolved as those on the refuge tree have emerged. It is our tremendous good fortune to be in contact with them, to be able to conjure them up in our minds, and thereby, at least to some extent, enter their world. Step by step, prostration by prostration, the refuges work their miracle of total transformation upon us. As we do this, our lives take on a deeper meaning. Being in contact to that extent with the refuges and all they represent, living under their beneficial influence, we come to have more and more to offer to the suffering world we live in. To begin with, we sit in meditation as a relatively fixed and solid self, building up the picture of the refuge tree. It is as if we are painting a picture in our minds, following a set of instructions. Avalokiteshvara has four arms. He is white. He holds a rosary and jewel. In time, though, the figures on the tree start to develop a life of their own. We feel less and less that we're building up a picture, and more that we are actually contacting another dimension of reality. As we experience things in this way, our sense of our being fixed, unchanging entities starts to diminish, and the boundary between ourselves and the refuge tree, ourselves and others, becomes more translucent. Over the years, the figures on the tree may begin to take on as much life as the I that supposedly creates them. The distance between us and them steadily decreases until finally we experience no distance at all. We become our own refuge. In going for refuge more and more deeply, we ourselves become in time a tree of refuge.